Thanks so much for downloading Manmade. Just a heads up that the following episode contains some strong language and we do discuss mental health issues. If any of it strikes a chord with you and you want to find mental health support where you live or talk about your feelings, visit the Hub of Hope, www.hubofhope.co.uk, where you can find links to services across the UK.
Have you ever seen Inside Out 2?
No, I've not. I can't because Sam's in it.
What?
Sam had a speaking part in it.
What? For who?
He was a fucking security guard, Sam, or something. A splat or some shit.
Sam's an Inside Out too.
Yeah, mate. They're very small. I mean, he basically told me he'd done, listen, I've got to go do the voiceover for Inside Out 2 or whatever it is.
I mean, it makes sense.
Like, he had a big fucking role and he basically just made a noise, I think. But either way, yeah, so I refuse to watch it.
You should.
Welcome to Manmade, a podcast hosted by me, Pete Wicks. Today, we've got Jordan Stevens of Rizzle Kicks. He's also a writer, really great guy. He's got a book, Avoidance, Drugs, Heartbreak and Dogs, which I particularly love. He is super, super eloquent guy. Really, really interesting. He's got some amazing points of view and some absolutely incredible takeaways. So I hope you enjoy this one. Mate, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure.
I am going to go straight in. We always do. It's Pete's Biggins.
Yeah.
Do you think you're a good man?
Ooh, amazing. No. I don't think so. But I don't mean it in a sense that I'm a bad man. I just don't think I subscribe to the idea of like being good or bad. I think I'm capable of both. I've made loads of mistakes, loads of regrets. I'm going to make loads more mistakes. And I don't think any of those should define me singularly.
Fuck me, that stumped me really, because you are the first person that has pretty much answered that exactly the way I would.
Yeah.
Almost identical.
Yeah.
I'd like to think I'm a good man, and I'm always striving to be a good man.
Right.
And that's part of the battle, I think.
I think it's, yeah, maybe that's the answer. It's a verb, not like a static thing. I
fucking love that.
Yeah.
Do you feel confident in your masculinity?
So I feel like more in touch with my masculinity than ever, I think. It was a big part of my recovery, was allowing myself to feel half of my being, you know, just like to be in that energy, however that feels for me. And I have a growing adoration for masculinity as an energy. I also have a belief that, it's not specific to men. I see that energy carried through all types of people. I do think that there might be some energies that are seen more commonly between men and women, but I think every human being can balance masculinity and femininity. Mm-hmm. In relationships, I've seen men and women shift and change what energy dependent on what's happened in life, you know. Sometimes you might be in a partnership and somebody loses someone and you need a rock to be your strength, your anchor for a second, and then they might dip and then you want to step up too. It shouldn't be, I feel like, you know, everybody has that responsibility to create a kind of sense of balance. And that might be friendship, all types of relationships.
That's very common as well. You're saying when you have someone around you who is going through a tough time or he's going through a period of self-weakness, stepping up is a displacement. It's something that I think I've probably done a lot over the years for different things, is it takes me away from my own problems. If I feel like I can help someone in their problems, then what I do is just leave mine at the door and I'm more comfortable doing that. Mm. But the problem with doing that is then I never resolve any of my own
shit.
You
need that too. You need it too. Yeah. That's so interesting you say that.
It's a
displacement. You're a caretaker.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like it's you know, empaths do it a lot and you know, people who quite often have a lot of their own shit. Mm. What they would rather do is help someone else, because actually it takes you away from that.
Yes, which is good in moderation. Mm. Being of service is an incredible part of being a human being.
Yeah.
It's like incredibly rewarding.
Yeah.
This is really cool how you said that, because that's a better way of me articulating how I feel about masculinity and femininity. I feel like it's just about opening and closing our hearts. Mm-hmm. Learning through life when to open and close our hearts, again, is like an ongoing process. So I feel like I'm open-minded, I'm open-hearted, but actually a big part of me growing up has learned that sometimes I have to protect my heart.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously we see a lot of people, mostly men, who have only closed their hearts. They've protected their hearts and they're never opening them. And then they end up becoming isolated, disconnected. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, you have people whose hearts are so open, they become obsessive and unable to stand up for themselves. So we have to find a way of having that mechanism to open and close our hearts. So I think that's what I mean. So to answer that question, yes, recently I've been able to protect my heart more, and it's allowed me to build closer relationships with, from a place of strength rather than desperation.
Love that. You've spoken a lot about masculinity and mental health, not necessarily specific to gender, but you know, part of this pod, it's about men, but it's not specifically for men. It's for women. It's for anyone listening, because we're all surrounded by brothers, fathers, and friends, and whatever else. What would you consider the biggest challenge facing men today?
I think right now things are shifting. You know, we're in a transitional time, and there aren't necessarily, I think, movements for men. Feminism has done incredible stuff for women. I know that Catelyn Moran talked about this on here, that the shift in the last 30 years has been insane. So now with boys, there's a fear because, you know, that's changing. And I guess with that, there hasn't been as much encouragement maybe for boys and men. And then also there's a genuine concern that in the future, AI, when it's shifting and changing jobs, it's actually putting at risk many jobs that are dominated by men. The fields that seem to be a little bit more secure are nurturance, interpersonal-based jobs, which are commonly dominated by women. We need to learn how to be present as fathers and to see fatherhood as a purpose beyond earning money and whatever else. It's like, we want to build the future, right? And enable that to happen. And then also being in the lives of children that aren't biologically ours, you know, primary school representation, nursery representation is really low for men, you know, because historically we're just not part of that bit in life. When I've looked at men growing up, and there's all these statistics about men in their 50s and 60s who have struggled to maintain close friendships and relationships, I've watched all these videos of millionaires and billionaires on their deathbeds all wishing that they had not just worked every hour of their living life and instead actually spent time with the people they loved. And so I'm like, this is a real wake-up call for men to understand that when I talk about emotional education or learning how to feel, which I've had to be instructed how to do that, you actually get taught. It's not intrinsic. It's not like a airy fairy, like, come on guys, it's peace. It's like survival. Like, this is how we're going to survive. Like, we're in the next phase now. We've spent so long identifying with the concept of being a machine that we've now made machines and we've almost put ourselves out of service. So it's like, what are we going to do? Are we going to evolve or be extinct?
You mentioned the way women have come on in the past 30 years. Do you think men haven't adapted and are now lost because we don't really know what we're supposed to do anymore? Lots of young men now, I think, are lost and broken, and they don't really know who they are. You know, social media is a wonderful thing, but also it's it's the fucking devil, isn't it?
Oh my God, it's completely...
Because you've got an awful lot of powerful people with a voice who are influencing young men in negative ways. And I think 100%. It's causing, you know, for younger guys, it's very difficult, because if you're not, if you're lost and you don't really know where you are, you don't really know who you should be, you're going to cling on to something that makes you feel like you're part of something, part of a movement. And unfortunately, on social media and what younger men visibly can see and hear, quite often it's quite negative, and it's not good people that are doing that.
There's been a wave. Listen, the last 5 years has 100% been a marked difference in the gender conversation, and my only concern is when those conversations are taken on by teenagers, for example, they don't have any of the other context to it. They've heard little bits on the internet and they'll just repeat it. I see a lot of people concerned with boys repeating it, but actually girls are doing it too, the same thing. They'll come in and be like, oh, boys are trash, whatever. And then if you're a little sensitive 14-year-old, you're uncomfortable, you know, you don't know how to deal with it. Another thing I want to be clear about, specifically with this time now, is for so long, I think the concept of being a traditional man has been so tied to money and power, right? And that has, certainly in my lifetime, I'm in a point now where I've never seen it more difficult for any human being to establish any sense of power or money. Like you say, social media, the people who get the most likes, the most retweets, it's always a showcasing of like
the best
luxury.
Parts of the life, luxury.
Like, and then there's promise of like, if you do this, you'll have this. If you do this, you have this. So people are like, buying into that dream and supporting it almost as a concept.
Because we're living in an age of smokes and mirrors, aren't we?
90% of us, especially London, is a growing wealth inequality. It's obvious, and people are caught in this thing where they feel disempowered by their world around them, they're trying to find power in little pockets, using it on other people, bullying other people, rather than just understanding that this is a problem all of us can deal with as a community.
Role models,
yeah,
and who younger men can kind of look up to. You said you kind of struggled to think of any male role models.
Yeah.
You grew up with around a lot of women.
Listen, man, like, I know that your book, correct me if I'm wrong, but the catalyst would have been the passing of your grandma. Yeah. I was like, well, man, maybe grandmas are the most important thing ever.
She was everything that a good person is.
Yeah.
And that was a role model to me.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I'd lost something that I'd cherished so much that everything is like, it's like opening the floodgates, and now I'm a fucking emotional peach.
But that was just,
I mean, I cry at Disney these days.
That's not something to be. They know exactly what they're doing.
Listen, I've started rewatching a lot of Disney, and I used to think,
Have you seen
Hunchback of Notre Dame? Got me the other day, mate. I'll tell you, the fucking.
Have you ever seen Inside Out 2?
No, I've not. I can't because Sam's in it.
What?
Sam had a speaking part in it.
What, for who?
He was a fucking security guard, Sam, or something, a splat or some shit.
Sam's an Inside Out too.
Yeah, mate, they're very small. I mean, he basically told me he'd done, listen, I've got to go do the voiceover for Inside Out 2, whatever it is.
I mean, it makes sense.
Like, he had a big fucking role, and he basically just made a noise, I think. But either way, yeah, so I refuse to watch it.
You should. My form of therapy that I did was called AEDP, which I talk about all the time, and that film is basically a really incredible explanation of how important that is. The reason I say that is, for anybody who has seen it, there's a moment where anxiety, the character of anxiety, gets like caught in this vortex. Just, it's so relatable that it's just me and my girlfriend are just there, and it's just like single tears. It feels so preposterous because it's just like colours on the screen. But yeah, they know what they're doing, Disney. But yeah, listen, the same thing for me, brother. When my book is about a situation where I was unfaithful with my ex-girlfriend. I told her.
So this is ADHD?
Yeah, avoidance, drugs, heartbreak and dogs. Basically, I fucked up in a relationship. I was honest. My ex left me, which I'm thankful for. It was similar. It was like the final rock in this dam just crumbled the entire thing. And the next day, the first thing I was faced with was the realisation that losing my gran 4 years before or whatever was the thing that fucked me up the most.
Yeah.
I adored my, I mean, both grands I adored, but particularly my dad's mum, just because I was just at her house more, and she really encouraged me to write. And the fact that the grandparents are a degree away from the immediacy of parents, you know, we don't realise how calming it can be to be around a person who's just had their life, they've lived their lives.
Completely.
But I actually also didn't, I never met my grandfathers. They passed before I was born. So yeah, for me, it was two grandparents, a mum, she had two sisters, they had a daughter each, and then one other cousin.
Because I think that's the thing. I was really blessed and lucky to have had my nan for such a long time, and I've never felt so lonely and lost after she was gone. And I think that was the point where I thought, fuck, because she was always my safety net. I used to speak to her every day. She was my best friend.
Yeah.
You know, if I'd have got married while she was still here, she'd have been my best man, point blank. So honestly, for me, when you kind of lose that, then you realise at 35 years old that I can't cope on my own. And like you said, there's kind of the rock in the dam, and as soon as that kind of breaks suddenly, and you start realising and learning, and mental health is a massive part of that as well. And I know you've struggled with your mental health, and you've been quite open about that, and you've had problems with addiction and drugs. And what was the kind of lowest point there, and how have you come from? I mean, would you say you hit rock bottom?
I think relative to my life, yeah. I think, because there is I can look out and be like, could be worse. But it was very complex for me, because essentially I fucked up and I was left in a situation where I was left. And I think I was fucking devastated. I had it ripped open, this abandonment wound that had been in my soul from when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't resolved that in myself, and it was only in this breakup where it was just like I say, it was like a plaster had been ripped off. I'd been running away from things with the drugs, and my coping mechanisms
was the breakup the kind of catalyst that really sent you on this kind of spiral with addiction and
no
or you were no doing so that previously.
What I think it was worth writing about in my book, especially for men, just because of the way it's worded, is that for me in my journey, I had to connect to my anger in order to find love. And I think for a lot of people, anger and love are understood as clashes. They're like things that can't exist in the same space. For my personal journey, I realized through therapy that every single spiral I went on from when I was 22 years old, yeah, doing a bunch of coke, drinking, going on a wild one, hedonism, all of that madness, when it was at its worst, I could pull it back to one moment where someone close to me who I loved had pissed me off. That was it. When I was a kid, I didn't want to upset my mum. I didn't want to upset my dad. So even though I was fucking angry, I was never like, ah, I was forcing myself to grow up faster than I needed to. And then now, yeah, and then I ended up, you know, 20 years later, not being able to tell someone, no. Pete, it was literally just, no, I don't want to do that. Or, no, I don't like how you've treated me. That's it. Instead, I would just destroy myself. And then ironically, with this case with my ex, I hurt her anyway. So I might as well have said, gone back and been like, no, I don't want to do that.
We have a fucking lot of similarities.
I know.
I always struggled to express or understand how I was feeling.
Yeah.
I didn't understand how I was feeling. So that would then present itself as anger. Or I would actually physically be very angry. And I couldn't understand why. It's not because I was necessarily feeling angry. It's because I was hurt by something else. I may have been sad, lonely, whatever
it may
be.
How did you express
it?
Would you actually shout?
Yeah, I mean, I used to fight a lot when I was younger. When I was younger. And then, you know, developing it, punching things, walls and whatever else, and going from 0 to 100 really, really quickly.
Mm.
But then coming down from that just as quickly. It was like just a way to release because I couldn't understand. I couldn't understand how I was feeling. And then once I'd had that kind of release, I would never get to the bottom of what made me that angry or why was I feeling that way. So I would just then hide that emotion away and then just blurt out again and have an angry episode. I never really knew why. And then actually, it was really nothing to do with being angry. It was because I was sad. I was lonely. It was because I was hurt by something. It's because I, you know, whatever it may be. But the only comfortable emotion that I could express was anger.
So probably should put a disclaimer that I myself not an expert, but just from my experience in therapy, I can guess what my therapist would say hearing that.
Mm.
And it's that what you're describing is rage.
Mm.
So my therapist makes a differentiation between anger and rage. In her mind, rage is 100 missed moments of anger being expressed. I'll use a dog analogy because I know you love dogs.
Yeah, we love a dog.
If I accidentally like step on my dog's paw, the dog will be like, ah! That's it, straight away.
What do they do?
Actually, I've practiced.
Just go. Sorry. Oh, it's good. I like it.
Just a little one to try. Yes, a dog will yelp. And then it's done. Wag the tail. We don't do that.
No.
So essentially what happens is we end up being like 1,000 yelps inside us. And then they come out as a roar.
That's a really great analogy.
Yeah. So my therapist had to trace backwards. And I actually was afraid of rage. So I would completely, you know, it would just be like, let me destroy my body. But essentially what we have to learn how to do is the anger in a healthy form is literally protecting the heart. Mm-hmm. It's literally a boundary. But because we don't get told how to do it, you would have had to go through so many situations where you feel someone's crossed your boundaries and you've never said anything about it, you know, and then it comes out as a fight with someone else.
Even that analogy, you know, we are going to talk about dogs because I know you love dogs and you're wearing a dog t-shirt. And you know,
this is actually my dog.
Yeah, well, it's just amazing. I love it. But one of the reasons that I love dogs so much and always have had such an affinity with dogs is because they live for the moment.
Yeah.
The one thing that they just want is love.
Bruv.
The one thing that they give you back is unconditional love, no matter what.
Bruv.
I have seen some broken, horrific situations with dogs, but yet you give them that tiny bit of love and whatever you get, it comes back tenfold.
Oh, no.
And that's why I've always felt safer, more content and happier around dogs than I have people.
Mm.
I'm just very comfortable around dogs and not so much people.
Listen, hard relate. Hard relate. I think there's a reason why people, I mean, look, in the context of me, and the reason why I put dogs in the title of my book is because rescuing my first dog, Spike, who actually is this dog here.
Also, he, love that you rescued.
Yeah. It's both rescues. And he, you know, really was re-engaging with that basic form of exchange of love. You know, like if I feed Spike, if I walk him, if I hug him, love him, then I come home and he's happy. And I think a lot of people in life end up feeling kind of invisible. There's so much pressure on us in the world to just work and work and work, and there's no time and da 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 da. The least we want is for people to be happy to see us. It's actually so sad to say, but it's just the reality. And sometimes we get into a mode where people are just, oh, you're right, mate, yeah. Or like, yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this one's like, woo! You're here. Yeah. And I'm like, I am here. Yeah. Yes, I'm here.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because we're complex beings, us fucking humans. Whereas dogs, it's I'm happy, I'm healthy, I'm happy. Yeah.
Even in the wake of struggle, there's something, a reason to be happy. It just, they just drop that shit. Yeah, like, yeah. They'll literally just be like, oh, all right, cool. I was walking a dog yesterday and this dog was, you know, had like lost the use of its back legs, had a little wheelie thing, and was also blind and deaf. But it was so funny because the dog could maybe smell me and kind of was bounding up like near in my vicinity.
Smelling Spike.
Literally just going like, rah, 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 rah.
Yeah.
And then she was like, yeah, yeah, you've seen a friend. And I just thought, whoa, you know, this dog is just buzzing. It's in the park still, not feeling sorry for itself, you know.
This feels more like we're at the fucking pub, and actually that makes me happier than sitting here reading questions to you.
Nice.
Because yeah. I think that is another thing that we as men don't do enough, which is just talk to each other. We are going to try and get back to it slightly.
Yeah, go on.
Toxic masculinity is something that you've spoken about previously.
I do, yeah.
You did an article, I think it's about 10 years ago.
Oh, wow, The Guardian one, yeah,
which,
yeah.
Mate, I've got a quote from it, which I just think is fucking fabulous, mate, honestly. This toxic notion of masculinity is being championed by men who are so terrified of confronting any trauma experienced as children that they choose to project that torture on the lives of others. Mm-hmm. Now, that was nearly 10 years ago. Do you think anything has changed?
No, I do, 10 years ago, yeah. I actually, just to give an evaluation of something that's changed, is I do feel more hesitant to actually even use the term toxic masculinity. I'll say two things about it. The first thing was when I wrote the article, that was a new term, which I, at the time, loved. So for me, there was no doubt in my mind that masculinity in its true essence was not toxic. But I feel like, again, because of the internet and because of, you know, the nature of the pendulum swinging,
it had become toxic.
Well, it's just hard to extrapolate masculinity from toxicity. And now people say things like positive masculinity or healthy masculinity. And that, in me, I think, no, masculinity is healthy and positive, just masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
What's wild is it's like two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. I grew up in a lads mag era. Women were being paraded on Saturday mornings on TV shows, Page Three, this kind of thing. That has 100% changed and shifted, I think, for the better. And like I say, for the empowerment of young girls and women, which is great. To the same extent, you have like petulant children who run entire countries. Like I say, I'm an optimist. I do think the conversation has been massively different. I think the boring answer is we've definitely improved in some ways, and then in terrifying ways, you know, there's still that quite an immature representation of masculinity. And the second thing I want to say quickly, to go back to the point about the breakdown, because I find it so interesting with this article. When I wrote that article, I was at my absolute lowest, and I think this is such a funny insight into careers. So I had spent 5 years as a pop star, right? But when I became a pop star, I was being critiqued as a pop star. Oh, he's an idiot. He's stupid. Look at these, like, you know, ungrateful sometimes if I was slouching on a couch or whatever on telly. And I was mouthy. I was a mouthy 20-something-year-old.
Oh, and I wanted to be, that surprises me.
And I wanted to be taken seriously. I wanted this whole thing of like, oh, da, da, da. And then I have this heartbreak. Mate, I'm in a car park, literally crying every day in this car park, yeah, smoking 100 cigarettes in my uncle's car park in Brazil. I thought I was being mad unique running away South America.
So, hold on. That is the weirdest fucking image in my head.
Yeah.
You're in your uncle's car park in Brazil.
So basically, crying,
smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, so I ran away to Brazil when I was heartbroken because I thought that was a really cool, unique thing to do, but apparently everyone with like 500 quid has done that. And so I ran away. My uncle lived in this place called Laranjeiras in Rio, and it was all, you know, picturesque or whatever, but I was essentially every morning having breakfast, going into a car park and just crying, smoking. And I can laugh about it now. I should laugh about it. I caught someone in the window once and I thought, this woman is just watching me cry every morning in this car park. Anyway, I wrote this article at my complete lowest. At this point I was like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
So I might as well say what I truly feel. And then I remember the person at The Guardian was like, we're gonna print this on Monday. I was like, all right, whatever, put it up. Time difference, I'm there crying in a car park, and then everyone wakes up and it gets shared like 50,000 times. I'm getting messages off like my old school bullies and shit being like, wow, man, what an article, you know? And I am just like, I am broken. And all the opportunities I wanted in life were being offered to me. Literally, like, I was getting emails from people going like, hey man, do you want to do a doc? Do you want to do a TV show? Do you want to do a thing? You know, I'm sure you've had similar experiences where it's just like, so the doors are open, but I'm there like, no, I want to just stop crying.
How did you stop crying?
I carried on in therapy. It took a long time, bro. Like, it was that trip was another 2 weeks. I came back home and I was very fortunate to basically go to a thing called The Bridge, which no longer runs, but it's an emotional trauma retreat.
So emotional trauma retreat, that sounds, even for me now as someone that is trying to do his best and trying to learn every day, that sounds fucking terrifying and like something I would avoid like the plague.
You'd love it.
Talk to me about it.
So on this retreat called The Bridge, this is where I learned that emotion isn't an optional thing. This is the whole conversation with men and boys about boys should cry, this kind of thing. But regardless of the clickbait version of it, all those tears I hadn't cried were actually trapped in my body, bro. And it's a 6-day retreat. And it's basically building up to a final day. So you do that through various things, shake, you know, there's like shaking and you'd like some meditation, you know, yoga, expected stuff, but then also more practical things, learning about relationships, learning about how to feel, what the emotions are. And yeah, bro, there was 14 of us and there were 2 of us were men. There's a documentary called The Work, which is only with men. But the point is, I found that understanding that I was being brought towards a point where I read out a letter. I wrote 2 letters to people in my life that I thought it was important to. And I was processing grief I'd had trapped in my body. And I literally felt this stress leave my body. I felt physically lighter after this week. And that's why I feel so passionate about when I talk about emotional literacy. It's not like, hey, be nice and say, it's like, nah, bro, you're going to have a dodgy back in 10 years because you're not crying. You're not processing how you're feeling.
It's mad that you say that because we had Billy Billingham on the podcast. Part of me writing the book and part of me doing this pod and everything else was because when I last time I did SAS, they made us write a letter as if you were dead. As if you were writing to someone back home, your family. And I'd never ever done anything like that before. And what I didn't know was that they were going to ask us to read them out. So I forcibly, because I was doing it because that was what we had to do, didn't think it was going to be read out or didn't think anyone would ever see it, wrote a letter to my mum and forgave her for things that I'd kind of held and whatever else. And for the first time ever, had put at the bottom of the letter, I'm struggling, I need help. And didn't realise that that was going to be a thing. And that's why I left that series, because I was like, this is a fucking TV show, I'm out. I cannot be doing this because I've never said anything like that before. And what you're saying about emotional kind of literacy there, that's really fucking interesting because, you know, there are a lot of key phrases and things that people like to say, but anyone that can't express themselves and doesn't really understand how to put things into words, you know, doing things like that,
it changed me. And I considered myself quite an open-minded guy, but I didn't actually understand why it was necessary to sit. Like, I was once someone in my early 20s, I couldn't be still. Too many, you know,
ADHD, has that affected you emotionally? How does that affect you when it comes to some of the things you've been through? I know you've probably been through a lot of this in the book, which is why people need to go and read it. But how has ADHD impacted your life?
One thing I don't want anybody to think, and I make this clear in my book, I don't talk about ADHD as an excuse for anything.
No.
I really don't. The only reason why I find it interesting is there are other people who have the same struggles as me. And I didn't even have words for these struggles. I didn't realize I was even in a state of paralysis until I saw, you know, like a psychiatrist talk about it on YouTube. If you saw it, it would probably look stressful. I'll be on a garden path towards my car and I'll just be stood there doing nothing for like 3 or 4 minutes. I'll physically stop. But the one thing I don't do, it's mad, isn't it?
It's just it's like the sort of you just sort of malfunctioning.
And it's like a glitch.
Like a glitch.
But the one thing I do is I try to just find ways in which to make allowances for those struggles. Obviously, organisation is something I struggle with, but I've learned ways to deal with that too. It's all about just adapting to the circumstance, you know? Everything I do in life is viewed through that lens. So I think people who have a similar lens to me will be like, oh, that's relatable.
I think you're incredibly relatable. And the way you speak and explain things is really easy, man. So, which I think is fucking incredible. Bear in mind, you know, Sam Thompson is my best mate. And
of course, you see it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But well, you said
he's my business partner. I work with it a lot. So it's...
But you said he's autistic ADHD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Or ADHD, they call that.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating. But he's also...
but
one,
I can see,
one of the best people I know, and if I could be more like him, then I would absolutely love to be.
I will take this moment to say that I think a large part of the reason why a lot of people really do think you're a brilliant person in this space, what you do talk about in your book, that is also really commendable, bro. Like, I know you said you had that moment in SAS, but you didn't necessarily have to go away and actually confront it. I just think that approach to life in terms of like, look, man, I've made some mistakes and I want to be better. I think that is universal, bro.
Yeah.
That's what people are drawn to. And that doesn't mean that you have to step up and be like this shining light.
No.
But there's a reason why people are drawn to that, because everybody has that struggle.
I appreciate that, my man. I think that's one of the things that I really enjoyed kind of doing this and speaking to different people from different kind of points of view is because you can always take something away when you actually talk about these things. And, you know, my kind of issue with men and what we're kind of told about men these days is that they're all lost and all they've got to do is talk. No one really does the work to do it. And what no one really asks anyone to do is listen.
Yeah, true.
And it's just as important. But it's finding the right people to listen to. And it kind of goes back to, you know, what we kind of briefly touched on at the start, which is who of young men, and not even just men, young people got to look up to as what you class a good man.
100%. I also think the reality is that when you're young, you know, you're drawn to the buzz. You know?
Bright lights and shiny things as
well. Yeah, man. And I feel like what I certainly want to do and I think I do see this changing is all of this chat about, you know, I guess goodness or health or whatever the fuck, that shit's sexy, man. Like, that's the thing you ought to try and tell these kids. The funny thing about the manosphere is these guys who are giving out dating advice are like fucking miserable and don't have long-term partnerships worth commending. So it's like, I find it funny to think, to the 14 and 15 year old boys, do you think the best advice towards finding a girl you like is to detest and deter any kind of space or thing that girls like?
Yeah.
Like, if you want to have sex, are you going to achieve sex by finding reasons to hate girls?
Yeah.
Like, this is heteronormative boys and men, yeah? Like, no. And so it's like, actually, probably listen to the boys and men who are, like, I'm telling you, I feel good. I walk my dogs in the morning. It's a fucking vibe. Do you know what's a vibe? Water. Do you know what's a vibe? Like, going to the gym with your mates, having a laugh, working out, but not making it my identity. That's a vibe. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, these are sexy prospects, bruv. Do you want to spend your first fucking check on a car you can't afford just to show off? No, bruv. You want to roll up in whatever the fuck, because your sense of self isn't in that car. It's in you.
That's such an amazing point that you're making there, is that your sense of self is in you. Clip the fuck out of that. Your sense of self is in you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, do you know what? Go on. We're done for the day. No, that fucking brilliant line.
It's true, though.
But 100%, I completely agree with you. Another thing that I always find really interesting when we kind of have guests on is finding out what they think makes a good man.
Yes.
So we ask everyone, what two qualities do you think men possess that can make them a good man?
Okay, so one I really feel passionately about, and obviously this isn't specific to men, but I feel like it's really been lost just culturally, especially in a Western world, is honor.
Mm-hmm.
And honor in its true sense.
What is that to you?
So honor to me is actually an innate sense of balance and equality. Understanding that it's the responsibility of the person with more power, in whatever means, to bring people up. Or if we're going to have a challenge or a battle, I can only be battling with somebody on an equal playing field to me. The battle's only worth it if there is equality there in the first place. Do you get what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we should be fighting for equality, because if we really are about it, we want everybody on the same playing field to have a fair fucking battle, you know,
yeah.
And like within, you know, battles being used loosely there. I think about it with like fights, you know. I remember, I actually think that fighting, there's a place for that, especially growing up. What I feel is missing and has changed is an understanding that there's no failure in losing a battle.
There's honor in defeat, 100%.
Yeah, I was saying this to my friend the other day, when we used to have fights in school, I remember we would all watch, but it wasn't, I don't know if it's changed now, because I'm not literally not young like that anymore, but
yeah, I mean, it'd be weird if you knew what was happening in school.
Yeah, I know. But there used to be fights and you know, and it would stop.
Yeah.
There wouldn't be people piling in and kicking people when I want to grab. It's like 1v1 until someone is looks like they're winning. We don't want people to get major damage. This is why I think it's so important with like martial arts, because there is honor and discipline innately taught with it. I see so many tricky things about people, like even in a romantic setting. Yeah, like I feel very passionately about everyone being taught about consent, you know, and understanding consent. Mm-hmm. I would argue, like, do we want to be in situations where like two paralytic people are trying to like, no, I'm just saying, or if we're like a little less drunk than like, I don't know if that's a vibe we really want to be engaging.
Yeah, where's the honor in that? Yeah.
As I've got older, that's something where I'm like, whoa, man, like, you know, where's the honor in that? You want to be engaging in something where there's the real understanding. That understanding comes from time and conversation and questions and curiosity. And so, yeah, honour.
You're the first person that said honour so far. The second one I've got here for you is, I don't fully understand it.
If I've put it before, I've forgotten what I said.
Stillness.
Oh, I did say stillness. Oh, wow.
So this is the one. Unsurprisingly, no one else has said stillness. What makes a good man? Just sit down and
Yeah, stillness.
What? Yeah. Explain that to me.
I don't even know. I think what I was going to say was consistency. Maybe I can blend the two. I'm trying to think why I would have said that.
You can go with consistency if you like. Stillness, just as a word, I just really enjoyed.
Yeah. It is. Well, I struggled with it. A lot of my life, stillness. I think what I was trying to do by saying that is I'm trying to take traditional notions of masculinity and not dismiss them in their entirety. Like I say, honour is a term. Has historically been new. I guess people imagine samurais or something.
Honor and death, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but I just think we've actually lost the meaning of that being, yes, equality in the battles. But with stillness, it's like the energy of masculinity is this, I don't know, it just feels like this rootedness, this anchorage, which I think people have misinterpreted as a rock that can't show any emotion. It's not that. The origination of Stoicism isn't to dismiss emotion, it's to allow it to flow through us.
And I think the reason I really like stillness is because it kind of gives me the idea of a moment of reflection. Right. You know, it's an opportunity to take a look at yourself and those around you and what's happening around you and reflect on where you see it. And I think we live in a world now where everyone is rushing. Everything we do is a rush. You have to do this and you have to do this and you
literally,
you know, kids want to grow up really quickly. Everyone's in a rush. But I think that is why there are so many lost people, is because when you are rushing, what you're not doing is taking the time to understand yourself.
100%.
And you can't really help anyone else or anything else until you help yourself.
And I think there's a strength. I don't know. It's like
there's a strength in it.
100%. And even with like voices, you know. I mean, I don't know if I'm getting a bit.
I'm also just absolutely obsessed with your impression of stillness right now. Because
I'm not still.
Just, you know, there's a
someone with ADHD not, saying stillness is the thing that we should look for in masculinity.
No,
I'm not.
The way you, I like it. I like it. It's also. It feels solid to me.
Well, I'm thinking like. Even with of like voices, if we think about differences that we can't, what makes us actually different biologically, and you know, for men, even our voices will be lower. Mm. And I think that shouldn't be used as a form of dominance. It almost feels like an anchoring.
Another really nice way to put it, actually, is maybe that is what we as men need to do more, is anchor ourselves.
Yeah,
slightly
anchor.
Yeah. Mate, you've been fucking brilliant and fabulous, and thank you so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure, genuinely.
Incredibly eloquent, and you speak really well, and I think you've got some amazing things to say to people.
Listen, the love is mutual, Pete. I'll tell you that for free.
And I would say that you are an incredible role model for a lot of men out there. Nice. And a lot of people out there. So you thank
too.
You, brother.
You too. Us and Bukayo Saka.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, 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 absolutely. As expected, I love talking to Jordan. I mean, we didn't speak about any of the things that I expected us to, and just went on some beautiful tangents. But that's the nicest thing about actually sitting down and talking to someone sometimes. As much as there are topics that I'd like to cover, sometimes it's nice to just sit down and talk to someone. That felt like I was at the pub with him, and actually he's got some really, really amazing takeaways that I think people need to hear. So yeah, Jordan Stevens, what a guy. Also really fucking cool. Jordan's Jordan is the first person that's come on this podcast who has openly said that he struggled to find good male role models, apart from me, which is interesting. And actually, we've had some emails and a lot of people have kind of got in touch with us. But this one from Evie, I think, really resonates. So Evie says, "Hi, Pete. I just want to reach out to you. I found the pod very thought-provoking, so I thought I'd just share a thought I had. Does it have to be a man that makes a man? I'm a single mother and have raised my two boys solo since they were 1 and 3. I've had to step into the shoes of both parents, so effectively also be a male role model without actually being male. Not an easy task. I also have 9 siblings, including 4 brothers. My parents often said, Evie has bigger balls than her four brothers. I think my parents mean I demonstrate more masculinity at times in the things I do and the way I carry out tasks than my brothers. Whether this is a result of being a single mother and having to survive for my boys or something else, I do not know. Anyway, just thought I would give another take on it and put it to you. Keep up the great work. Your nan would be proud." Jordan and I both said that our nans were probably big role models for us, and that's the person that I would consider to be my role model. So I completely agree with that. Finding a male role model, it can sometimes be tough, but masculinity isn't just about being a man. So Evie, yes, you 100% could be a male role model, if you like. I don't know about your balls, though.